Thank you, Dan. All right, the Lord's Word is a lamp to our feet, a light to our path. It's also the bread that we cannot do without, and we have been enjoying reading the Lord's Word together throughout this year. This past week, these are the passages that have been in our reading, 2 Kings chapters 14 through 19 from the history part of the Old Testament, the 105th through the 111th Psalms, Isaiah chapter 1 through the middle of chapter 9, and then the Gospel of John chapters 8 through 12. I have enjoyed hearing the passages that have stuck with you. Which ones have been your favorites of these readings? Which ideas stuck with you? Clay?
I'm looking at 2 Kings 19 and verse 7. The king of Assyria had come to capture Jerusalem, and God said, I'll send a river, and he will turn around and go back.
It's one of the, I guess, not only the power of a rumor, but also one of the great lessons of the kings is what small things God could use to overthrow their big, powerful plans. And that's one of the lessons in 2 Kings 19 is a great one. Who else has one? Any passage that stuck with you that you want to mention? Gail?
Well, my Bible says 105 is the Psalm of Thanksgiving, but I took it as a history lesson.
Yes.
106.
Yeah, I like especially Psalm 105 and the different ways that it shows the kind of trouble the people got in or the difficulty they got in, and God brought them out of it, and they ought to give thanks for his steadfast love, and that pattern through that whole passage. And one of the things about some of these psalms that we want to remember is that we're the next part in the story. Our story fits in that as well. And I think that's one of the salvation history psalms. It's a great lesson. Anyone else? Phyllis?
Well, I like John 12 and 9. And it just amazed me that they was going to become Lazarus as well as Jesus, because he brought him to life and made you that there would be more people that would believe.
Yeah. Think of the futility of their efforts. How do you think you will succeed if you're going to kill a man who's already been dead and has been brought back? Wouldn't that be kind of, how'd you like to have that job? You're going to kill a guy who he just walked out of the grave, and they had to take the grave clothes out of him and loose him and let him go. I think you'd get the impression you have a job there that you might not going to accomplish. The other part of that lesson that so amazes me is I think generally people think that if you could just show me a big enough sign, I mean, heal somebody or raise the dead, or if I could see what they saw, even though I don't believe right now, I would if I could see that. And when the Lord raised up a dead man, that only increased the opposition. It didn't make unbelievers believe as much as it, well, the hard-hearted ones, it made them more set in their stubbornness. So that's a thought-provoking thing about that. Who else, if anybody? Dennis?
Well, I like the ninth chapter of Isaiah, not particularly the one that we are so familiar with about his name shall be wonderful and so forth, but in that second verse of Isaiah 9, which is a prophetic statement about the Lord, how that he would go into the land of the Gentiles in the early part of his ministry. It is repeated again back over in Matthew 4, I want to say about verse 11 or so, verbatim.
Yeah.
And that, of course, plus other things in that ninth chapter, gives great reason for us to think about Isaiah as the messianic.
Yes, I agree. In fact, I agree so much, that's the passage we're going to study. Yes, it is. Isaiah 9. No, don't be sorry. That means we made a good choice. I want to mention two or three passages from these readings that that maybe you noticed too as being particularly important. All of us need to be readers, thoughtful readers of 2 Kings chapter 17. The biography of national failure, which is described in 2 Kings 17 as the end of the story for the northern kingdom, occurs. The northern kingdom, Israel, the fall of Samaria, and so forth. And then the explanation, the prophetic explanation of the series of events that had occurred, should make all of us stop and think about community life. Even though we don't stand as a nation in the same covenant relation with God as Israel did, it still is thought-provoking what can happen to the fabric of national life. In 2 Kings, the story of Hezekiah in Judah is very thought-provoking in chapters 18 and 19. How can a man of such great faith turn out to be so selfish and act so unwisely? In one chapter, he's the man who spreads it out before the Lord and asks the Lord's help. In the next chapter, he's so unwise as to show the Babylonians everything in his house and then to say, as long as there's peace in my days, it'll be all right. Jim?
Many years, this passage or two verses have, I know, had an influence on me. I hope the whole Bible, of course, but it has inspired me and encouraged me, and that's John 8, 31, 32, where Jesus said to those Jews that believed on him, "If you continue in my word, they know you truly my disciples, for you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free."
That's like exactly the opposite coin of 2 Kings 17, the opposite side of it, and what a great passage that is. Remember also John chapter 10, the Good Shepherd chapter. John chapter 11, the resurrection of Lazarus and the Lord's statement, "I'm the resurrection and the life." Those are great passages. And then what sometimes is called the Gospel of Isaiah because of the prophecies of the Messiah. There are several parts of this wonderful book that are really thought-provoking, but in chapter 1, you get an idea of how sin looks to God. You ought to read it that way. Christians are people who want to learn to recognize and to respect in the sense of seeing what an enemy it is, the nature of sin, and Isaiah chapter 1 does that. And then Isaiah 5, the vineyard that has all the advantages, but it brings forth wild grapes, and then the six woes of Isaiah in Isaiah 5. You want to be familiar with that great passage. And Isaiah 6, the call of Isaiah, where he sees the throne high and lifted up. And remember the holy, holy, holy song that's sung around his throne. You see there, and that's a great passage. But Isaiah 9, I want for us to consider tonight. This was our reading for today, or one of our readings for today. And of course, as Dennis said, the more familiar statements of this are verses 6 and 7, which we'll return to later, but let's remind ourselves. "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this." The weight of meaning that that statement has in the whole Bible is inestimable. It's present throughout the story, and we'll try to see it tonight. And I'm not going to put a bunch of other notes up here, but I do want you to think about with me about the fact that this statement, as meaningful as it is, does not just spring on the scene as if it came out of a vacuum. There is a background to it that gives to that underlines the power of its meaning. And I want to take a few minutes here to point out to all of us that this part of Isaiah, this vision of Isaiah, really starts in Isaiah 7. In Isaiah 7, there's the picture of what this means to the whole, the situation meant to the whole nation. In Isaiah 8, what it meant to Isaiah personally. And then Isaiah 9, what it means to the story of the Bible as a whole. Take a minute maybe to look at it in these ways. I'll try to make it where you can remember with me this way. Let's start first to say there is a rest of the story to this, historically speaking, that's mighty important. You notice in chapter 7 at verse 1 beginning that this happens in the days of Ahaz. Ahaz being the first one mentioned here. Now, you read some about Ahaz this week, and one of the reasons I chose this passage is because it corresponds with the readings from the Kings that we've had. Ahaz becomes the king in Jerusalem, in the southern kingdom, about 736 B.C. or about that time. And the events that are talked about here happen about 735 B.C. Now, if you think of the Old Testament history, then you know that the northern kingdom of Israel gets carried away by the Assyrians in 722 B.C. So this is like 13 years before that happens. Now, there are two things about the background that I want for us to be aware of. One is the international situation. At that moment, the clouds were gathering, as our diplomats these days would describe it, the clouds of war, the threatening clouds of doom were gathering over on the horizon to the northeast, off in the land of Assyria, off between the Tigris and Euphrates, off in the direction of Persia. The Assyrian power, with kings like Pul and Tiglath-Pileser, and both of those are mentioned later on, Shalmaneser and characters like that you'll read about in the Old Testament, are becoming the very cruel and dominating, fearful force whose activities threaten all of their neighbors. And what happens about 735 here is that the Syrian, now notice this is a different, the Syrians were where Syria is now. Damascus was the capital even then, and it's a different land than the Assyrians were. The Assyrians are the mighty power. The Syrians are Israel, the northern kingdom's nearest neighbor, and an old-time enemy. But Israel, the northern kingdom, who has at this time a series of weak kings who fall one after another, several of them assassinated, a terrible time of turmoil, the Israelites and the northern kingdom made a league or an agreement with the Syrian, not Assyrian, but Syrian king Rezin, R-E-Z-I-N. They made a a pact or an alliance to help protect each other, they thought, from the Assyrians. Knowing that they were still too weak to defend themselves, they sought to enlist other partners, willing or unwilling. And they wanted one of those partners in their league of defense to be Ahaz and the people in Jerusalem and Judah. Ahaz was unwilling. But instead of turning to God and depending on God, old Ahaz took the silver and gold out of the temple, out of the house of God, and sent it to Assyria, to the Assyrian king, to hire him to protect Judah and Jerusalem and Ahaz from Syria and Israel. Syria and Israel were upset, and they went and fought against Judah during this period of time. Actually engaged Judah in battles. And you read about this in 2 Kings 16 and then in 2 Chronicles 28. You know, I'm quickly summarizing the story. I want you to think, though, of the irony of Syria and Israel being on the same team. Remember that during the days of Elijah and Elisha, Syria was as bad as you could get. Now they're on the same team, and then them fighting against Judah to join them, but Judah sending to Assyria and paying the Assyrians with the stuff out of God's temple to protect them. All right. The Assyrian tyrant king came and fought against Syria and Israel and defeated them and captured Damascus and all of that. And all that's where the character of our friend Ahaz, the king, the Davidic king in Judah, comes into play. Ahaz was a fellow. You know some about him already if you know that instead of his praying to God, he would hire the Assyrians for protection. When the Assyrians conquered Damascus, Ahaz went up to visit them, the Assyrian king at Damascus. And while he was there, he noticed the huge altar that was at Damascus. Remember, the worshipers on this altar had just been defeated by the Assyrians, but Ahaz got himself a copy of the plan of that altar, sent it back home, had one built, had the brass altar, the brazen altar, moved out of the temple and had this Syrian altar raised up there and burned sacrifices on it. That tells you something about him as well. One of the things I notice about Ahaz that is emphasized especially in 2 Chronicles, also mentioned in 2 Kings 16, is how he, when he was attacked by his enemies, he began to worship the gods of his enemies. It's hard to see how that makes sense, especially for someone who believed in the God of heaven at all. But he started engaging in the terrible kinds of sacrifices and practices of the nations around him, one of which was the burning of his own sons as sacrifices to idols. And I noticed that both 2 Kings 16, right at the first of the chapter, first three or four verses, and 2 Chronicles 28 both emphasize this. 2 Kings 16 says he burned his son. 2 Chronicles 28 says he burned his sons. Did it more than once. And the Second Chronicles passage says the worse the problems got for him, the more faithless he became in engaging in these terrible practices. All right, so that background you need to bear in mind when we're reading this. Now, to make it manageable memory-wise, let me say next in the story that sons play a big role in the message of Isaiah chapter 7, 8, and 9. Sons and the names of the sons are an active part of the revelation that takes place here. And I wonder if part of the reason for this is not what Ahaz had done to his sons. I can't prove that, but the more I read the passages, the more likely I think it is that God uses this method of making his message known because of what Ahaz had done to his own sons. And this happens now in three ways in this broader text. First, through the names of Isaiah's sons. Isaiah had one son named Shear-Jashub, in Isaiah 7 in verse 3. And the key thing is these names all have meanings. This name means a remnant shall return. This great people of Israel is going to be reduced to a remnant, but a remnant will return. He has another son whose name is Meir Shalal Hashbaz in chapter 8, verse 3. And this one means the spoil speeds, the prey hastens. In other words, it is a name which meant a message of defeat to somebody and a message of victory to somebody else, as we'll see as we go along here. That's one of the names that is used here. There is another name that appears three times in our passage, in the broader passage, and it's the name Emmanuel. Emmanuel means what? God with us. All right. And here's the passages where this occurs, chapter 7 and verse 14, which we'll mention more in just a second. Then in chapter 8, in verse 8, it is used, the name Emmanuel is used as an address. 7:14 is a prophecy. 8:8, it's an address. It talks about your land, O Emmanuel. And then, not as apparent to us in English, but in chapter 8 and verse 10, the last clause, the name Emmanuel appears as a sentence. God is with us, which is the meaning of the term. So that name is one that is extremely important. And then you notice the focus on the name of the one promised, the child promised, in Isaiah 9 and verse 6, where his name will be called Wonderful Counselor and so on. So notice what I'm saying. You've got a king who, instead of seeking God's help, calls for Assyria, burns his own sons as sacrifices to the idols of the nations. You have a prophet who has two sons whose names carry great meaning in the historical setting with the lessons he wanted to communicate. Then the name Emmanuel, which is used in three different cases here to try to say God is involved, God is with his people, God can guide and keep and take care of his people, and then God has a promise for his people. All of that is a part of this. And then that kind of brings us to the issue here of this is kind of a who do you trust passage. You got this king doing this. You have this God trying to say this. So, which one's right? Who do you trust? Who do you depend on? And just looking quickly through the passage, I want to point out these statements to you that I think are key to the whole deal. Notice in chapter 7 in verse 2 that when the king of Syria and the king of Israel came against Jerusalem, the house of David, read that, this is verse 2 of chapter 7, read that to mean Ahaz, was told that Syria was in league with Ephraim, Ephraim being another name for the northern kingdom. The heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. There is the need now that Isaiah is trying to address in these passages. God has him, has the prophet to take his son to meet Ahaz, and he has him to tell him in verse 4, be careful, be quiet, do not fear. And this is, I'm reading from the English Standard Version here, but think about what a lesson that would be. Any self-talk for us this week there, be careful, be quiet, do not fear. That's a pretty good message in itself, isn't it? All right, and do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands. That's what he calls the king of Syria and the king of Israel. What does it suggest to you when they're called two smoldering stumps of firebrands? What message is in that way of talking about them? They're about to go out. They won't last long. Smoldering means they're on the downhill side of this, all right? And he tells them at the end of verse 7, God says it won't stand. It shall not come to pass. He talks about that. At the end of verse 9, and I'm told that there's a play on words here that's hard to translate. In English versions, at the last sentence in verse 9, if you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. And there'll be that gets translated in maybe different ways to try to show how picturesque the language is. Jim?
Bill, what is your take on, if you don't mind, I don't mean to get away, but here in chapter 9, Isaiah, where Jesus is called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. What is your take on, in what sense, he would be the Everlasting Father?
Okay, can I save it for a minute till we get over there? Okay, that's okay. We may have to. Let me try to do this one as quick as I can, and we'll get down to that. I want you to see. I want all of us to see. The point of all of this is not to, what Isaiah is trying to do is not to confound, not to puzzle, but to tell this foolish king that if he would spend as much time and energy in trusting the Lord and being faithful to him as he is in trying to pay off Assyria and depend on him, he'd be all right. If you're not firm in your faith, you're not going to be firm in your government. You're not going to be firm in your security. You're not going to be firm in your home life, your national life, or anything else. The Lord then says to Ahaz, verse 10, ask a sign. And you got to remember, to appreciate this, you got to, what God is doing, you got to remember where Ahaz is coming from. This is a guy who's burning his kids. This is a fellow who's turning everywhere but where he should for his help. This is a guy who is doing everything but trusting God. God invites him to trust. And Ahaz says, verse 12, I'll not ask. I'll not put the Lord to the test. What a hypocrite. I'll not put the Lord to the test. When he moved the altar out in front of the temple and put an altar like the one in Damascus there, and then to say, I'm not going to put the Lord to the test. You see the foolishness in that, don't you? And so this is when God makes the promise about the virgin who will conceive and bear a son, and his name will be called Emmanuel. In verse 16, before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. And think about the time frame. This happens in 735 B.C. In 732 B.C., Syria and Damascus fell to the Assyrians 3 years. By the time a child could be born and be able to tell right from wrong, these kingdoms already begin to fall. Ahaz, you should not let your whole permanent attitude, value system, and faith system be determined by something that's going to be done within 3 years. Don't choose a permanent solution to a temporary problem, in other words. And there are a whole bunch of lessons in that, folks, and that's what to say. Now, Ahaz didn't listen. He went ahead and sought out the help of the Assyrians, and what he did is to unleash a flood eventually on his own land. When the Assyrians came down there fighting against Israel, they looked over south and saw Judah. They made Judah pay heavy tribute, heavy yearly payment to the Assyrian king, and then eventually in a few years they came down there and tried to wear them out. And were it not for the rumor that Clay talked about in 2 Kings 19, they'd have carried everything off right then. Well, that's what happens. I am going to have to deal with the great passage a little bit later. I want to mention to you notice that in 2 Kings 7, verse 17 and following, it talks about what the Assyrian king would do to Judah. The help that Ahaz sought out turns out to be disaster for his own people. Now, in chapter 8 of Isaiah, what happens is that God says, since the people have refused the gentle waters, chapter 8, verse 6, the waters that flow gently, this is probably the waters that flow into the pool of Siloam in John chapter 9, the same spring. Then there will be the waters of the river Euphrates, that will be like a flood sweeping down into Judah and making the land be up to its neck, about ready to perish. And at this point, the people are divided into two, either with Isaiah, who are taking sanctuary in God, or with Ahaz, who are stumbling over God as a rock of offense. This becomes important in understanding the role of Jesus later on. Isaiah and his people and those who are with him, verse 17, decide, I'm going to wait for the Lord. I will hope in him. I and the children whom the Lord has given me are signs and portents in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells in Mount Zion. That'd be Isaiah and his sons and his prophesying family, apparently. On the other hand, the people who, instead of being true to the Lord, inquire of spirits, try to communicate with the dead, who talk in gibberish, as if somehow they were going to learn something from there, are going to end up in terrible darkness, cursing their God, experiencing distress and darkness and the gloom of anguish. Chapter 8, verse 22. And that's when the chapter 9 comes onto the scene. Now, you can read chapter 9 for your own against the background we've just offered, and it'll mean more to you when it says, "But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, the two farthest northward areas in Galilee. But in the latter time, he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles." That's where the ministry of Jesus starts. Matthew 4, as Dennis said earlier, "Then the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them light has shined." This is quoted with reference to the ministry of Jesus also. Starting really from Luke 1 and verse 79 onward, this, instead of darkness, light. John 1 verse 5 is one of my favorites. "The light has shined in the darkness, and the darkness has not put it out." And that idea is terribly important. And God multiplies the nation which had been reduced to a remnant, and they rejoice like people at the harvest, or with, like people who've won a battle. The burdens have been, the yoke has been removed, the staff has been lifted, the rod of the oppressor has been broken, all of the materials and armament of war and enemies are burned up in verse 5, and then a child is born. Now, this is, I think I can bring the point of what I wanted for us to see down to a conclusion here. And think about it this way, and it goes with what Clay said at the very beginning of our class. If you put this in context, all of it, Ahaz sought an army. God brought a child. That's what Isaiah 9 is saying. Ahaz took all the gold and silver of the temple and paid the Assyrians to end up destroying his own people. So God brings a child whom he gives to bring a rule of righteousness and justice and the experience of peace forevermore. And it's accomplished not by the foolishness of a faithless king, but by the Lord's own jealousy for his own name and for his own people and his own nature. And you think about it that way, that helps to see the story of the Bible in a lot of ways. Isaiah 9 in verse 6 mentions the four names of Jesus, which we'll try to take a little time and talk about maybe next week, because it fits with so much of the message of the Gospel of John as well. Jim? I think it would, yes, I think it would. I appreciate y'all being with us tonight. I hope the rest of the week goes well for you and your loved ones. Try to find somebody to be a blessing to. Let's pray before we go. Father, thank you for the gift of your Son. Thank you for the great eternal purpose which brought his ministry into reality. And thank you for your wisdom and love, for your justice and mercy, for your righteousness and grace, which brought together all of these elements that we read about here in his life and ministry. And thank you that we have a Savior who can rule over us and bring peace to our lives. Thank you for the time spent together here and for everyone present. Bless each life, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you, guys.